This podcast contains explicit language. Listener discretion is advised. The following program presents an examination of a criminal investigation. Any individual who may have been investigated or faces criminal charges continues to be considered innocent until proven guilty.
911, what's your emergency? My granddaughter has been taken. She has been missing for a month.
Her head is bleeding severely. We need an ambulance.
This is Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48, the podcast. I want to thank you for sending in some really great questions on the Chandra Levy case. I'll answer them when we do our mailbag at the end of this show. Now, let's get into this week's case.
If somebody would have asked me who is Robert Blake, I wouldn't have known. The only thing I would know him from was the Little Rascals.
Robert Blake was a Hollywood fixture, with a career that began in the late 30s and included starring roles in films such as In Cold Blood and the popular TV show Beretta. But by the 90s, he'd largely dropped off the radar, until he wound up as the prime suspect in the murder of his second wife, Bonnie Lee Bakley, on May 4th, 2001. Although no one questioned the fact that Blake had motive, and the evidence against him seemed compelling, the jury found him not guilty. I wanted to investigate the Blake case because it was an example of yet another celebrity who was acquitted of murdering his wife, although the evidence against him seemed strong. On my A&E show, Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48, we took a deep dive into the Blake case, and we uncovered some surprising new evidence, but what we didn't cover on the show was the reason for the verdict. In spite of what seemed to many was a very strong case, the jury acquitted Blake. Was the evidence not as compelling as the media made it out to be? Or did Blake's celebrity, and possibly the murder victim's unsavory past, cause the jury to subconsciously reject the evidence of guilt? We'll hear from reporter Eric Leonard, who was in the courtroom throughout the trial, as well as two of the jurors who were in the criminal trial. But first, let's get into the facts of the Robert Blake case. Robert Blake casually, and briefly, dated Bonnie Bakley after meeting her at a jazz club. By no means was she the love of his life. They only hooked up a few times before she got pregnant. That definitely wasn't Blake's plan, but unbeknownst to him, it was Bonnie's. It was her lifelong dream to marry a celebrity. The pregnancy was her ticket to fulfilling that dream. For years, she'd been running a mail-order business in which she'd send nude pictures of herself to men and put ads in Lonely Heart magazines, advertising for a male companion. When men responded, she'd get them to send her money for car fare or airfare, then claim she needed more money due to car trouble or whatever, and then usually never show up. The scams netted her enough money to buy several houses. Now, by no means was Blake the first celebrity Bonnie Lee Bakley had targeted. Before meeting Blake, she'd gone after Dean Martin and Jerry Lee Lewis and other famous men, like Christian Brando, Marlon Brando's son. Anyway, Bonnie got pregnant. Though she'd hooked up with Blake once or twice, she was still seeing Christian at the time. When Bonnie had the baby, she thought Brando might actually be the father. But a DNA test proved her wrong. It showed Blake was the father. Now, you might say Bonnie was a successful, albeit kind of sleazy, entrepreneur, but you probably wouldn't pick her to be the mother of your child. Robert Blake, knowing her past, wanted her to have an abortion. Here's a conversation Bonnie recorded between her and Blake around that time.
What's awful?
Everything. I know what you're going through, and I wouldn't want a kid around either if I was going through all that.
You know, if you're going to do it, you have to do it really soon.
I don't want to do it.
You swore to me on your life that no matter what, I didn't have to worry. And that was a rotten, stinking, filthy lie, and you deliberately got pregnant. Not an accident. You deliberately got pregnant. Your period ended on August the 20th, and you were out here...
No, the 24th.
You were out here f***ing me on the exact day that you were supposed to. You did all that. You did it. And for the rest of your life, you'll have to live with that. And for the rest of my life, I'll never forget it.
Don't do this.
I'm not doing anything, sweetheart. It's all okay. Okay, you go ahead. Live your life. I'm not the bad guy. I didn't lie. I didn't cheat. I can't do that kind of thing. The aura would get me. If I ripped somebody's heart out that I loved and I did it deliberately, ripped their heart out, make them crawl and squirm, that's tough stuff. That's really tough. I mean, it doesn't stop me from caring about you and wanting to be with you. But,
it sounds like it does.
I'm not going to lie about who you are and what you are. Baby, the ball is in your court.
She refused. She had the baby. Then she took the baby with her to Memphis. Her message to Blake was clear. If you want to see your child, you'll have to marry me. So he did. Divorce wasn't an option. At best, he'd have to share custody of the child with Bonnie, and at worst, he might lose custody altogether. That their marriage was doomed to failure was easy to predict. That it would lead to murder was not. When we come back from the break, the murder of Bonnie Lee Bakley. You know, I find it so important to take the time to look at the world through new lenses, get fresh perspectives. I'm sure it's the same for you. I mean, that's why you're listening to this podcast, right? The Great Courses Plus is a streaming service created for people like us. Get unlimited access to learn from the world's top professors and experts in virtually any category: history, science, psychology, even how to write or take better photos. You'll get unlimited access to over 10,000 lectures with flexibility to watch from your laptop, your TV, your tablet, or your smartphone, or you can listen with the Great Courses Plus app. They make it so easy. I personally want to recommend that you check out the course Forensic History, Crimes, Frauds, and Scandals. It explores some of the most fascinating investigations in history using modern tools of forensic science to help solve the mysteries that puzzle detectives for decades, if not centuries. I'm talking about Jack the Ripper, the Romanov murders, and the Black Dahlia case. I mean, that one has everybody, including me, completely fascinated. I want you to enjoy the Great Courses Plus, too. And for a limited time only, they're giving my listeners a free month, a whole month of unlimited access to all of their lectures. But you need to sign up through my special URL to get that free month. So, sign up using thegreatcoursesplus.com/MCI. I mean it. You're going to love it. So sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/MCI. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/MCI. And we're back with Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48, the podcast. On the night of the murder, Robert Blake and Bonnie Lee Bakley went to dinner at his favorite restaurant, Vitello's, in Toluca Lake, California. According to Blake, they'd finished dinner and returned to the car when he realized he'd left his gun behind in the restaurant booth. He claimed he'd been carrying it to protect Bonnie because she'd scammed plenty of men and one of them might come after her. Instead of using the valet next to Vitello's, Blake had parked the car on a residential street a couple of blocks away, next to a lot that was under construction. A large dumpster was parked just in front of the car. Bonnie waited in the passenger seat of the car while Blake left to get his gun. Blake said that he went back to the restaurant, found his gun on the seat of the booth where they'd had dinner, and then went back to the car. There, he found Bonnie slumped over, bleeding. He ran to a nearby house and found a helpful neighbor who called 911. That neighbor then went over to the car to see to Bonnie. But Blake left and ran back to the restaurant for help. A school nurse at the restaurant responded to the call. She went back to the car and tried to give Bonnie CPR, but it was a lost cause. Bonnie had been shot twice, once in the neck and once in the shoulder. Shortly after paramedics got her to the hospital, she was pronounced dead. Once police had arrived at the scene of the crime, Blake gave them the gun he'd claimed he'd retrieved from the restaurant. At that point, he was just a witness. He agreed to go to the station and talk to the investigators, but he refused to take a polygraph test. Then, investigators tested Blake's hands for gunshot residue. Now, gunshot residue is basically the blowback that occurs after a gun's fired. It's like dust, and it gets on your hands and sometimes your clothing when you fire a gun. But like dust, it falls off your hands pretty easily. And if you wash your hands, or if you rub them on anything, like grass, for instance, or through your hair, the gunshot residue will come off. Robert Blake did both. Not surprisingly, then, relatively little residue, only 5 particles, were found on Blake's hands. The next day, investigators searched the dumpster that was parked just in front of Blake's car. They found a vintage World War II 9mm pistol, a Walther P-38. It was cocked and ready to fire, and it still had a bullet in the chamber. Police would later determine that this was the murder weapon. Later that same day, investigators searched Blake's house. They found two 9mm handguns, $12,000 in cash, and a 100-count box of 9mm rounds. That's the same caliber as the bullets used by the gun that was a murder weapon, and the box was missing three rounds. That looked promising, but police ultimately determined that the bullets were not the same make or manufacture as the bullets fired by the murder weapon. So there was no physical evidence that tied the gun to Blake. The police strongly suspected Blake of killing Bonnie Bakley. The motive was obvious. He wanted to get rid of the grifter who'd purposely gotten pregnant and then maneuvered him into marrying her. And Blake's behavior on the night of the murder was bizarre. Who leaves a gun behind in a restaurant and then lets a stranger tend to his wife while he runs back to the restaurant? And on top of that, the first responding officer noted that Blake didn't really seem upset, that he seemed like he was trying to act like he was crying, but that there were no tears, and that when he tried to console Blake by saying Bonnie would be okay, Blake looked anxious, not relieved. But this is what I call soft evidence. Everyone reacts to trauma differently. Strange behavior may just be that. Strange. It would take another year before police would finally get their big break in the case. A retired stuntman called the police. He said Blake had asked for phone numbers of two other stuntmen he'd worked with, Ronald Duffy Hamilton and Gary McClarty. These two stuntmen told police that Blake tried to hire them to kill Bonnie just 2 months before she was murdered. Both of them turned down the job. Finally, the police had a case. On April 18, 2002, Blake was arrested and charged with one count of murder with special circumstances of lying in wait, two counts of soliciting murder, one for each stuntman, and one count of conspiracy to commit murder. That same day, police arrested Blake's bodyguard, Earl Caldwell, and charged him as Blake's co-conspirator, an accessory after the fact. Detectives had found a pistol similar to the murder weapon in Caldwell's apartment and a shopping list in his car that seemed to be a list of items needed to commit and then cover up a murder. Blake paid all Caldwell's legal bills and posted his $1 million bond. But ultimately, the evidence against Caldwell just didn't come together, and the charges against him were dropped. Now, the media fascination with the case was intense. It was a surefire ratings boom with a TV star at the center and salacious elements abounding. Blake had been a famous child actor, but he'd been out of action for quite a while. Now, he was back in the limelight. And even though it was because he was charged with murder, he seemed to enjoy the attention. He loved giving jailhouse interviews to TV anchors. Now, I can tell you, as a former defense lawyer, that makes for a nightmare of a client. The very last thing I'd want my client to do is talk to a reporter, and on camera no less. Because no matter how savvy or smart they are, or think they are, 9 times out of 10, they're going to piss people off, then they'll tank their case. Which is why Blake went through more than his fair share of lawyers. He lost his first attorney when he agreed to sit down with Diane Sawyer against his lawyer's advice. He lost another attorney when he agreed to do an interview with Barbara Walters. And by the time trial actually got underway, Blake was on his fourth lawyer, Gerald Schwartzbach. The police and prosecution had worked hard to put the case together, but there were no eyewitnesses, and there was no DNA evidence or fingerprints on the murder weapon to link Blake to the crime. That's trouble in today's world, where the people who sit on juries have been conditioned to expect a whole panoply of physical evidence. It's what we call the CSI effect. I talked about it before, in the Casey Anthony case. The gunshot residue evidence was also problematic. The test done on Blake's hands only turned up 5 particles. Not much. The defense made that a central focus of their case, and presented an expert who said that Blake should have had over 100 particles on his hands if he'd fired the murder weapon. And I talked to a number of gunshot residue experts about that. They all agreed that there's no way to accurately test how much residue would be left after Blake ran to the restaurant to get help, drank 2 glasses of water there, which is what he said, then ran back to the crime scene, put his hands in wet grass and in his hair. And those are just the movements we know about. In my opinion, the gunshot residue evidence was a big wash, a big nothing burger. It didn't prove or disprove anything. But what the prosecution had in spades was evidence of motive. Several witnesses testified to hearing Blake say he wanted out of the marriage, and to their belief that he was capable of harming her to do it. Bonnie's adult daughter said Blake would call and threaten her, mistaking her for her mother. And then there was Blake's strange behavior, his fake tears, and the fact that he claimed to carry a gun to protect her, but then left her alone in the car on a dark street with the window rolled down. And why not drive back to the restaurant to get his gun? He could easily have just told the valet to hang on to the car for a minute while he ran inside, especially since Blake was a fixture at Vitello's. They'd have been glad to accommodate him. The prosecution also presented the witnesses who were at Vitello's that night and who said they never saw Blake come back to retrieve his gun. A busboy testified that he bussed the table right after Blake and Bonnie left, and he didn't see a gun. And then there were the stuntmen, Hamilton and McClarty, the core and beating heart of the prosecution's case. Both of them testified that Blake offered them money to kill Bonnie. They both turned down the job. McClarty said Blake pitched four different murder scenarios, including one that involved shooting Bonnie outside the restaurant where she ultimately was murdered. Hamilton testified that Blake said he hated Bonnie for trapping him in their marriage with her pregnancy, and that Blake wanted to be at the scene when she was killed. He gave a very detailed account of the meeting when that conversation took place, including the restaurant where they met, Dupar's in Studio City, right down to the pancakes Blake had for lunch. Detectives found a receipt for that meal that corroborated his account. And that's not the only point police were able to corroborate. Hamilton said he also advised Blake to buy a phone card so their calls wouldn't show up on his bill. They bought it at a convenience store nearby. Detectives found the receipt for that, too. There's more, because Blake screwed up. He used the card from his home phone. He was supposed to use it from a payphone. That meant the police could easily see who he was calling when he used that phone card. And they found out that Blake only used the card to call two people, McClarty and Hamilton, the stuntmen. Now, it's not DNA, but it's pretty compelling evidence. But these stuntmen were not an easy sell for the prosecution. They were rough characters. They had a past. Both had done drugs, a lot of drugs. Hamilton admitted that he'd been using meth and that he'd had a hallucination that he was being spied on by 20 men. And they both had spotty memories. So they contradicted some of the things they'd said earlier, before the trial, at the preliminary hearing. And of course, the defense put Bonnie's lifestyle and character on trial. It's the most common defense strategy. Dirty up the victim so the jury won't care about her. And a jury who doesn't care about the victim doesn't mind acquitting the defendant. Then, especially if your client's a celebrity, jurors will sympathize with him, and they'll hate her. And by the way, Blake's hair turned completely gray by the time of trial, which made him look older and more frail, more like a victim than a murderer.
I don't think I'm overstepping to say this, but the way the courtroom appeared to the jurors looked like the defense was in the weak position.
Remember, at the head of the show, I mentioned the reporter, Eric Leonard. I'll be letting him take the mic to paint a picture of the trial.
You had a prosecution table with main prosecutor, legal clerks, LAPD detectives, an audiovisual technician. It was like this gang of people on one side, and then there's little Robert Blake and Jerry Schwartzbach all by themselves on the other table. Just the two of them looked like they were facing off against a big squad of people who were out to get him.
And here's what the juror Chuck Safko told me.
I think all of us jurors thought Robert Blake was in a world of hurt.
Because why?
Because the attorney just seemed like he was just there. He didn't have much to say.
Didn't light you on fire.
No. I mean, we were all like, wow, he's... Well, this is going to be a tough one, I tell you.
Which only served to help the defense underline the sordid nature of Bonnie's past, and they did. They put on evidence of her mail-order pornography business and her history of conning men. and that, in turn, supported the defense argument that one of those men she'd conned likely wanted her dead. And of course, they capitalized on the fact that Bonnie had been seeing Christian Brando at the same time she was seeing Blake, and that Christian was upset when he found out the baby was Blake's, not his. And they played that tape, the one where Christian warned Bonnie that she was playing a dangerous game, that someone might get angry enough to shoot and kill her. According to the defense, that showed Christian Brando was the killer, or that someone close to him killed her on his behalf. I thought this particular gambit was a loser. First of all, I listened to that tape. Christian Brando was actually telling her to be more careful. He was warning her about others, not himself. Second of all, he did have an airtight alibi. He was out of the state at the time of the murder, and there was no solid evidence that anyone else committed the murder for him. And I should add right here that the police combed through all of Bonnie's mail and all of her voice messages, everything they could find. They did not find one threatening letter or one threatening voicemail message, not from any of the men she had conned. Anyway, the jury deliberated for 9 days. I asked a juror on the case, Roberto Emmerich, to help me better see what they saw.
Did it ever get heated back there?
I remember a couple things where, you know, people had it backwards, like where they were saying, they got to prove to me that he's innocent. I said, wait a second here.
No.
I heard one juror say, what are they going to think about us if we let this guy go?
Ooh.
And I said to them, you guys are all going at this the wrong way. They're going to think crap about us no matter what.
There's a lose-lose.
But ultimately, they acquitted Blake of murder and one of the solicitation charges. They were deadlocked, 11-1 for acquittal on the second solicitation charge. The judge ultimately dismissed it. Blake was a free man.
So, at the end of the day...
Yes.
Not guilty. Were you surprised?
I think my surprise came at the end of maybe the first or second day of deliberations. What could they be talking about? Either they buy it or they don't.
Right, right.
So, no, it wasn't a surprise that it was not guilty 9 days in.
And what the jurors said after the verdict showed me that they'd basically rejected the entire prosecution case, even seemed to have ignored it in some respects.
After the break.
Are you hiring? Hey, Epi, are you hiring?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Who are you hiring?
It's too many to go into, but I know ZipRecruiter can find them all.
She's right about that. ZipRecruiter can find them all. If you're hiring, posting your position to job sites and waiting and waiting and waiting for the right people to see it. And that's why ZipRecruiter is perfect for us. ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just 1 day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you get, so you never miss a great match. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/MCI. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MCI. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. We're back with Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48, the podcast. Several jurors called the prosecution's evidence flimsy. The jury foreman said the prosecution's case, quote, tended to be disjointed and it tended to rely on unreliable people, end quote. But information looks different when you're in the jury box. So I asked a juror on the case, Roberto Emmerich. So you saw the stunt men testify.
You know, I mean, anybody who followed it basically saw the same thing that we saw. One of them was really out there with his alien stories.
Eric Leonard again.
So mixed in with the recollection of what they were there to testify about were things that may or may not have been reality.
And the jury foreman called stuntman McLarty, quote, a prolific liar, end quote, who, quote, couldn't get his story straight, end quote.
I mean, his credibility was shot when we found out that he was already had been busted and he was looking to get his sentence reduced. Right. So people will say just about anything.
And I can't imagine a worse witness for the prosecution, because here you have somebody who very legitimately has something important to tell the jurors.
Oh, let's tell everybody what that is.
The stuntmen reported that they had been approached by Robert Blake in different scenarios to act as hitmen and murder his wife, Bonnie Bakley. That was their testimony.
Yeah. At the same time, though, the police did corroborate, in part, what they were saying.
Very key parts of their stories. So in any investigation, as you know, you never take anything at face value, and you always try to find something else, footholds, things to build up the legitimacy of whatever it is that you're trying to prove or disprove. And I don't remember what they were, but there were very specific things, phone records, calling cards, right. Meeting dates.
There receipts.
Receipts.
Yeah.
There was enough there to show that an interaction had most likely happened. It felt undeniable.
They needed to do a lot more than that. I mean, a receipt for a lunch. These guys were colleagues, right, in the movies. I mean,
right.
That doesn't really...
Because nobody recorded these conversations, you were left with, do you believe them or don't you believe them?
Now, I get why the jurors might have been skeptical of those stuntmen, even though some important aspects of their testimony were corroborated. But what I don't understand is how the jurors got around one particular thing. Something that struck me as I investigated the case. And it felt to me like, no pun intended, the smoking gun. The real linchpin. It's the fact that the murder weapon was found in the dumpster in front of Blake's car. Now think about it. If someone besides Blake, say one of the men Bonnie had conned, committed the murder, why on earth would he leave the gun in the dumpster, where police could and did find it within hours? Why take the risk that police might find DNA or fibers or hair that might link him to the gun?
I don't know. I mean, if it were me,
mm-hmm.
I would have dumped the gun right away, right?
Yeah, but
what's
why
the chances
there?
Of getting up the street and you get stopped by a cop who happened to be passing by and hearing something?
I don't know.
Really? It's risk. Hey,
would you dump it there at the crime scene? Doesn't that
murdering
seem...
Murdering somebody is, I mean, come on. I mean, what's the right way to do it?
Clearly you should ask me.
Right? I mean, come on.
And here's what another juror, Chuck Safko, told me.
I mean, it was convenient that there was this big dumpster, construction dumpster, that was full of stuff. One of the things they brought up is, why did he park down the street behind the dumpster?
Right.
Okay. Well, that particular restaurant was very busy at the time. Mm-hmm. There's very little parking. There's very little parking on the street. You park basically where you can get a spot.
And how would a third party know that when Blake walked back to the restaurant, supposedly to retrieve his gun, that he was going far enough away for long enough to come up to the car, shoot Bonnie, and then get away? It just makes no sense. But here's the thing. If the killer is someone who can't leave the scene, then it makes total sense that the gun would be left in the dumpster or somewhere else close by, because that killer would have no chance to do a great job of disposing of the murder weapon. But I wonder, did the jury realize that? Did they consider that? If not, would that point have changed their minds?
On the one side that he parked, there was the dumpster block in the front. There was the house that had a big wall up that was under construction, so you know nobody's there. But right across the street, there's a house where the front door faces their car.
Mm-hmm. Here's Eric Leonard again.
One thing that happened in the trial was the judge allowed the jurors to visit Vitello's and the crime scene.
Oh, they
and
did.
I was one of the pool reporters that got to go with them. So I went on the jury walk. And they were all brought out to Vitello's at the same time of night. And walked to the crime scene, and then did the Robert Blake walk. Robert Blake was such a fixture at Vitello's that he always sat in the same place.
Right.
And the booth that he sat in, there was a bit of an obstacle course to get there. You had to go through the waiting area. You had to walk past an area that was exposed to the big dining room. You had to walk down a hallway that puts you directly in line with one of those swinging kitchen doors. Right. And then you had to make a right turn and a left turn. That would be the path you would take to be seen the least. So I remember sitting in there, watching the jurors go by, and thinking to myself, my gosh, it just doesn't seem possible that somebody could make all these moves into the restaurant and not be seen.
Here's Chuck again.
I mean, I don't pay a lot of attention to people coming in and out of a restaurant.
There were people standing outside the restaurant smoking at the time he mm-hmm. claims he went back in and out, who didn't see him.
Yeah.
Back to my conversation with Roberto.
So when they took us out there at nighttime to go see the scene, Maybe I went beyond what I'm supposed to be doing, but I was looking to see if there was any water spigots around, to see maybe if he had been able to wash his hands behind the restaurant. I didn't see any of that stuff. The amount that was produced when this gun was test fired, it's not going to come off you that easy. Even if you rub your hands together vigorously, there was no way he would have been able to get all of it off of him. I'm an avid gun enthusiast. I go to the range all the time, mm-hmm. and I've sat next to people who are firing guns next to me, mm-hmm. and I can feel the powder coming on to me mm-hmm. from their gun. It gets everywhere.
But here's the thing. Bonnie wasn't shot at a gun range. She was sitting in Blake's car when she was shot. There's no question that the killer pointed the gun through the window of the car. And that's important, because what it means is that most of the gunshot residue wouldn't spray all over the shooter's clothing. In fact, most of it would stay inside the car. And what little gunshot residue might escape would be on the shooter's hand, or at most his arm.
Well, they didn't find anything on the sweatshirt that he was supposedly wearing. They found a very, very small amount, they said, on his hands. Mm-hmm. And that's where some of the police testimony came in, that they saw him sitting on the ground, wiping his hands on the grass. He should have had more on him.
That's the impression you came up
with. That's the impression I think most of us got.
The jury foreman, Thomas Nicholson, said, quote, "They couldn't put the gun in his hand. There was no gunshot residue, no blood on clothing. There was nothing. It was supposition more than evidence," end quote. But the prosecution had explained why there wouldn't be blood on Blake's clothing, and it's very simple. The blood never got further than the inside of the car. Now, Blake was ultimately found liable in the civil trial, but you can't compare a civil trial to a criminal trial. In a criminal trial, the prosecution has to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. It's the highest standard of proof there is. In a civil trial, the plaintiff only has to prove guilt by a preponderance of the evidence. That means the plaintiff only needs to show evidence that's a whiff more than a 50-50 chance that the defendant is guilty. Practically the lowest standard of proof. Also, in a civil trial, the plaintiff gets to call the defendant to the witness stand, and he has to take the stand. A prosecutor in a criminal case can never do that. It would violate a defendant's Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, the right to remain silent. At Blake's civil trial, the plaintiff called him to the stand. He screwed himself, got argumentative, got nasty with the lawyers, contradicted himself all over the place, and the jury foreman of the civil trial said, quote, "In going through the evidence, we believe Mr. Blake was probably his own worst enemy on the stand," end quote. I really appreciate the fact that Roberto and Chuck were willing to come and talk to me and tell me why they reached the conclusion they did. And, you know, reasonable minds can differ. But even though reasonable minds can differ, I feel like the jurors simply didn't want to believe Robert Blake was guilty. I mean, the witnesses who were just everyday witnesses with no axe to grind, who said they never saw Robert Blake come back to find his gun. And if he lied about that, when you take into account the rest of the evidence, you have to believe, at some point, that it was Robert Blake who killed Bonnie Bakley, not some unknown third party. I investigated the Robert Blake case on my TV show, Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48. I uncovered evidence that shed new light on the case. So tune in and watch. It airs April 19th at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Standard Time and 8 p.m. Central Time on A&E. Or find it online at aetv.com. And now it's time for the mailbag, when we answer your questions from the show last week, Chandra Levy. And with me to read your questions is the ultimate in mailbag readers, Epi.
I made her say that. Once again, your viewers have a lot of questions. A lot of people, Monette, Adam, Terry, Sid, Mary, you know, the Charles, just to name a few, they all are very interested in knowing how Chandra Levy got to the park.
That's a really good question. So first of all, she lived pretty close to the park. She certainly could have walked there. It would have been a long hike, but it was very hikeable. Or she could have hopped a bus, and she could have taken a cab. It seems unlikely she would have done that, and I do believe the police checked taxi records to see if there was any record of her taking a cab there, so I don't believe she did that.
So you want to take some transportation to the place where you're going to exercise? It's like me fighting for the closest parking spot to the gym door.
It's a little bit. Well, but you know something? If you what you want to do is, it's a big, big park. That place is huge. And it looks like she was trying to get to the nature center because she had downloaded a map that showed the nature center's location in the park, which is a really cool place to go. But that's a long, long walk. So if you're not up for quite that much, mm-hmm. yeah, you might take a bus.
All right.
But they did not establish how she got there.
Another popular question, like droves, want to know, there seems to be a lot of question about Guandique's robbery motive. Why would really robbery be the motive for the other joggers or, you know, even initially Chandra? Because joggers aren't known for carrying, you know, their bearer bonds and Krugerrands and stuff like that. I mean, I don't even like to carry myself.
They don't believe Guandique's story. They don't believe that he was just trying to rob these women when he attacked them in the park. And because why would you attack a jogger, of all
right.
things?
Well, and he never took the stuff.
All they had was a Walkman. So, and the Walkman, which, you know, they dropped it when he attacked them. Mm-hmm. But he didn't grab it and run. He
right.
left it there. It makes no sense that he's just attacking these women to rob them because you don't expect to see anything on someone who's jogging and walking and exercising. Who carries a bunch of stuff?
No, I mean, as some of your listeners have pointed out, if you're really robbing someone to rob them, get them somewhere where they have something, waiting at a bus stop with your purse, you know, at parking garage, parking lot of something, you know, somewhere where somebody has their purse or something like that.
Yeah. You're going to look for somebody who looks like they got something to steal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I agree with them. You know, to me, Guandique was really a very good suspect. And it's a real pity they didn't do more with it.
And then there's the other side who are saying, you know, it's just weird that she left with just an iPod and a ring.
I don't think it's weird that she left with just her keys and wearing a ring on her finger. If you're jogging, even if you're just walking, less is more. Who wants to carry a bunch of stuff?
And another question is, if there was no involvement from Condit, which your listeners, for the most part, do not believe, they're wondering if there was any other suspect besides Guandique.
Guandique was the only other suspect that they ever really got close to.
Mm-hmm.
And I, as I said, I think he's a good one, but they still need to really pursue him.
Right. Mike, we're talking about Guandique's going back again and again and again to the same spot. And many, many other people were saying, what is this about?
So I talked to Dr. Rossmo about this very issue and said, you know, why does he keep going back? And it seemed, I broke it down with him, pretty obvious. The thing is, yes, May 1st was when Chandra Levy disappeared. Most likely that's when she was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had two other women who were attacked within weeks thereafter. The thing is, he keeps going back to the same place because it's familiar to him. And he kept not getting caught. As long as it's working for him,
mm-hmm.
why wouldn't he keep going back? You know, I'm making an assumption that he's the killer. I'm assuming for the sake of this argument only that he is the killer. It actually makes great sense. He lived near the park. He was very familiar with the park. He found Chandra. He got away with it, assuming. And then he attacked this one woman. She couldn't identify him. He got away with it again. And it was only after he attacked the second woman in the park, very shortly thereafter, she could identify him. Finally, he got arrested. So it actually makes sense that he kept going back.
Right. Kate wants to know. Hey, Kate.
You guys are buddies, you and Kate?
We're going to be very soon. I'm quite delightful, so I'm sure we're going to hit it off immediately. Kate wants to know about Chandra Levy's clothes, that in the episode it seemed that they were intact, even after a long time in the underbrush and perhaps underwater at some point. No flesh on the bones, but the clothes were intact. Is that usual, unusual? I mean,
that's very usual, and that's because the reason that the flesh is not there anymore is skin breaks down more quickly than clothing. Animals also get to you. The animals don't like clothing as much. Yeah, they can't eat the cotton T-shirt. It's really kind of awful to talk about, but that is really common. So animals, insects, all kinds of things will get to
mm-hmm.
flesh
right.
that will not be interested in clothing. Thanks so much for your questions. I'm looking forward to answering your questions about this week's case, Robert Blake. Just call 402-882-6474. That's 4028-VANISH. Or you can email your questions to us at marciaclarkpodcast@aenetworks.com. Either way, I'll answer your questions on the next episode of this podcast.
Okay, now we didn't want to ask anybody to do anything because life is already hard enough.
Yeah, we know you're busy.
Yeah, and you know, and I'm even not that busy, but I don't want to take time to this. But then we found out that it actually really mattered. So if you do like the show, if you could help us out by just take a few seconds and subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, it really does help. It really matters.
And you matter. You really do matter. So anyway, thanks a lot. So appreciate it. Bye, guys. Next week, the Spreckles Mansion case.
Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48, the podcast. Hosted by Marcia Clark. Produced by Emil Klein and Chelsea Great. Research by Robin Kiyomi. Supervising producer is Scott Brody. Executive producers are Marcia Clark, Ted Butler, and Peter Tarshis.
And special thanks to Eric Leonard, who was a guest on today's episode. Be sure to check out his investigative reports on Channel 4, KNBC.
Music is by Blake Maples.
Special thanks to Rob Wood, Boom Tech. Wait, are we giving this guy credit?
We're distributed by Audio Boom. The TV series Marcia Clark Investigates, The First 48, is produced by ITV and airs at 9 p.m. Thursdays on A&E. Find out more at aetv.com.
But hang on. Any information, communications, or material you submit to the Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48 podcast by email, download, telephone, or otherwise is non-confidential, and AETN is free to use and reproduce such submission freely and for any purpose. Please see the site for complete submission terms.